Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In this series, we offer crime and mystery stories from the back issues of our magazine, usually read by the author. This episode features The Method in Her Madness by Tom Savage. AHMM published the story in June 2005, and it was shortlisted for a Barry Award. Tom Savage is the author of the thrillers Precipice and Valentine, which have recently been re-released as ebooks. His novels Scavenger and The Inheritance will be released as ebooks soon. Tom blogs at his website, tomsavagebooks.com. And now, Tom Savage reading his story, The Method in Her Madness.
She knew she shouldn't be in here. This was his sanctuary, his private domain, his holy of holies. If he found her here, he would not hesitate to call the police, or worse, and he would be back any minute. Still, she had to do this. The voices had told her to do it, and the eyes were watching her. A sudden flash of light at the big window of his oak-paneled, book-lined study was followed almost immediately by the sound of crashing thunder. The muted noise of the rain continued from outside, beyond the leaded glass and the red velvet curtains that framed the casement. She stood in the center of the room, the water from her wet blonde hair and her stolen black trench coat slowly dripping onto the oriental carpet, listening. The rain, the echo of thunder, the heavy pounding of her anxious heart, otherwise nothing, for now. At the moment, she didn't hear the voices. "I really shouldn't be in here," she said aloud, and then she focused on what she must do and went over to his desk. She knew everyone else in the house was gone. His wife, Dolores, was playing bridge at her club in town, as she did every Saturday night, and the servants had the weekend off. He was alone here, or so he thought. She was in this house with him, in this thunderstorm, and anything could happen to her when he discovered her presence. Even so, she knew she must confront him now, tonight, and make him understand. She had to persuade him to do the right thing and tell everyone the truth about her, admit to them that he'd lied about her to get rid of her and save his marriage. So much depended on convincing him to do this. Her reputation, her happiness, her freedom, her very sanity. Sanity. That word again. How many times had she heard that word in the last 3 years? Those three long, long years in that awful place, with its constant stream of doctors and nurses and specialists. The drugs to make her sleep, the drugs to wake her up, the drugs to keep her calm and prevent her from harming herself or others. That was the excuse, anyway. The drugs were really to make her docile, manageable, unable to tell her story clearly and ask for help. He had ordered this treatment of her, and the doctors and nurses readily obeyed him. As well they should. He was one of the mental hospital's major benefactors, and he had easily convinced the judge that she belonged there after she'd attacked him. Attack, indeed. It had been a fight, just an ordinary lover's quarrel, and it hadn't taken place in this very room. He'd told her they had to stop seeing each other, that his wife had found out about them, that he loved his wife, that it had to stop, and she, well, she had resisted the idea. They'd said ugly things, and he'd slapped her, and then she'd picked up the letter opener on his desk. It wasn't really a knife, just a silly letter opener, and she hadn't cut him badly, only a scratch. A few stitches, and he was fine. But to hear what he told the police after he summoned them, you would have thought she'd assaulted him with an axe. Later, at the hearing, he told the court all about their most intimate conversations, how she'd admitted to him once or twice that she sometimes heard voices and felt eyes watching her. She never should have told him about that, but how was she to know he'd one day use it against her in his zeal to be rid of her? He was Clifton Taggart III, America's leading Shakespearean scholar. She was merely Jessica Lohman, a poor, gullible college girl, an English major who dreamed of someday being a novelist. She'd only taken the part-time job as his personal assistant to help pay her tuition. She was nobody, really, but she'd had a record of psychiatric counseling for chronic depression and fighting with other children in school and a brief bout with anorexia. The depression had been with her on and off since she'd lost her father, and the fighting in school hadn't been her fault. That stupid Sally Denning shouldn't have called her a weirdo in the playground, right in front of all the other kids. She hadn't meant to hit Sally quite so hard, and the dentist had fixed Sally's two broken teeth, so what was the big deal? The eating disorder in college had only lasted a year. Well, 2 years. Mrs. Parker, her high school guidance counselor, and not a professional analyst, had been called as a witness, and the nasty old bag had offered the court her ridiculous opinion that Jessica was a borderline schizophrenic with tendencies toward paranoia. Then the dean of her college had testified, telling everyone about the anorexia and that other little incident in college when she threatened the psychiatrist. The judge, not surprisingly, had accepted all this and announced that Jessica would be remanded to Northern State Hospital. When he'd asked Jessica if she had anything to say in her own behalf, she'd been sobbing too hard to utter a single word. The final bang of his gavel still echoed in her ears these 3 years later, mingling with the sounds of rain and thunder from outside. They'd only let her out once in all this time to attend her mother's funeral, and even then she was under heavy guard. Her father had died when she was 9 years old, and her mother had always been in delicate health. The shock and stress of Jessica's commitment to a mental facility had sent Mother to an early grave. She'd stood in the freezing cemetery, flanked by hospital attendants, staring down at her mother's cheap pine coffin, the only one she could afford, silently cursing the man who had caused all this, the man whose testimony had caused her to be institutionalized. The man who had murdered her mother as certainly as if he had shot her. He'd told her mother and everyone else in the courtroom, in the world, that she was insane. "But I'm not insane," she thought. "I'm not." She allowed these thoughts to register, and then she reached down and swiftly pulled open his desk drawer. A memory of his old habits came back to her, and his old phobia, his constant fear of robbers. Well, with his fortune, or rather his wife's fortune, that was quite understandable. He'd mentioned to her once, back in the good times when she was still his part-time secretary and full-time lover, before their abrupt parting of the ways 3 years ago, that he kept a loaded revolver in this drawer. Papers, pens, yes, here it was. She felt the cold metal touching her fingers, then grasped the handle and slowly pulled the gleaming black object out and held it up to the light. She stood there behind his desk, peering at the alien thing in her outstretched hand, feeling its chill. It was then, in that suspended moment, that she experienced the distinct, familiar feeling, as frightening as it was welcome. She became aware once more of the eyes watching her, and she heard the voices. They weren't speaking, not words that she could hear at any rate. They were merely whispering, gasping and hissing in the darkness over there, just beyond her vision. Their noises of shock and outrage were informing her that she was bad, that what she was doing was wrong. The disembodied voices were her frequent companions in the hospital, some days her only companions, and she had mastered the self-preserving art of subverting them, of ignoring the sounds and pretending they weren't there, particularly when the doctors were with her. Tonight, away from the hospital, the voices seemed unusually agitated. She would not listen to them, not now. As another bolt of lightning flashed and thunder cracked outside, she slowly lowered the heavy revolver to her side and slipped it into the pocket of the black trench coat. She gazed carefully around the room, orienting herself, making a new catalogue of this familiar environment. She'd been in this place many times in the days when she was his secretary. Over there was the door to the kitchen at the back of the ground floor, the way she had come in tonight. On the opposite side of the room was the bigger door, the one that led to the central hallway and the rest of the house. In one corner of the room, in front of the floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, was the 5-foot marble column on which rested his most prized possession, the huge marble bust of William Shakespeare. She stared at the gaudy tribute, shaking her head slowly and smiling in mild disgust at the arrogance of the man who had placed it there. He was upstairs, probably planning his evening's work, some new and brilliant essay on some Act III speech by Festy or Hotspur or Beatrice, no doubt, to be included in his next major tome, which would have some title like The Origins and Interpretations of Gesture and Regional Grammar in the Bard's Second Period, 1595 to 1601, A Consideration. He would be changing out of his dinner clothes into his silk pajamas and red satin smoking jacket. Smoking jacket, his fancy phrase. It was a bathrobe, for heaven's sake, but Clifton Taggart III, America's leading Shakespearean scholar, didn't wear a mere bathrobe. Oh, my dear, no. Clifton Taggart III wore a smoking jacket. She hadn't made any sort of plan before coming in here. She'd managed to slip out of the hospital undetected, which had actually been much easier than she'd imagined. She'd simply swiped the trench coat and a nurse's cap from the closet nearest to the dorm, thrown them on over her nightgown, and walked right out the front door, nodding to the doddering old security man at the front desk as she went. He'd actually glanced up from his newspaper and waved to her as she passed him. Then she'd made her way here, to this house. A little over a mile in the rain, but she'd kept to the fields and woods beside the roads, and no one had seen her. Well, no one had noticed her anyway. Why should they? A tall young woman in a belted black coat, hurrying through the light rain that would soon grow heavier, was hardly an astonishing sight. The two remarkable details of her appearance, had the people in the passing cars been close enough to see, were the white cotton nightgown under the coat, and the fact that she was barefoot. The only shoes she could find in her haste in the pitch-black dormitory were her slippers, paper-thin little things, fuzzy and insubstantial. She hadn't put the slippers on, and she hadn't dared to feel her way over to the communal closet and rummage for her sneakers for fear of waking one of the others. So, a plan. Well, she could hide in here, but where? She looked around her, assessing each section of the room for potential places of concealment. Another flash of lightning at the window made her look over there again, and her gaze slowly lowered from the red velvet curtain-framed glass to the matching red velvet upholstered cushion on the deep shelf at the bottom. She smiled. The window seat! She'd forgotten all about it. With a swift glance over at the door to the hallway, she moved quickly away from the desk and over to the window. She reached down, feeling the soft texture of the rich crimson material on the cushion, then grasped the edge firmly in her hands and lifted. The entire top of the seat came up on its silent hinges, and she rested the cushioned shelf against the window frame, gazing down into the large, empty storage space inside the seat. She was standing there, staring down, when she became aware of the new sounds. Not the voices, not this time. These sounds were different in quality, and they were not products of her fevered imagination. Someone was coming down the main staircase to the hall. Clifton. She glanced over at the door, then down at the open window seat. She could get inside there and hide, wait for him to leave the room again, or... No. She hadn't come all this way to be a coward. She would stand her ground here, now, in this room. She would do what she'd come here to do. She was Jessica Lohman, and she would confront her enemy. With a decisive little nod of her head, she slowly closed the lid of the window seat and walked forward into the center of the room. She stood there, facing the door that would open at any moment, aware of the eyes watching her and the whispers. They were waiting here with her, waiting to see what would happen next. And Mother was with them. She could feel her mother's intense, loving gaze upon her. Yes, Mother was here with her, and everything was going to be all right. The door opened, and he came striding confidently into the room. Her heart leaped and her stomach lurched when she saw him, and she willed herself to control them. He hadn't changed much, she noted instantly. Tall and handsome, with his dark eyes and trim mustache, and the attractive streaks of gray at the temples in his otherwise glossy black hair. And yes, indeed, he was wearing the red satin smoking jacket over his silk pajamas. She'd known he would be wearing it. When he saw the young woman standing in the middle of his study, he froze. He actually emitted a small gasp and took one awkward little step backward toward the open door behind him, staring. There was a single second of pure terror on his face, and she felt a thrill of triumph surge through her at the thought that she had caused him even this momentary distress. He recovered quickly. In the next instant, the vision registered on him, and he recognized her. He sucked in a long, deep breath, and his dark eyebrows shot upward in what might have been quizzical amusement. He apparently decided that he was not in danger, and he carefully shut the door behind him and stepped forward again, immediately taking charge of this new situation. "Most sure the goddess on whom these heirs attend," he announced in his rich, deep voice, flashing that deceptively easy, offhand smile that had once thrilled her. Now she found it repulsive. She found him repulsive, and more than a little ridiculous. He stood there, smiling at her, and she could feel his gaze raking over her, making a study of her from her wet hair to her dripping trench coat to her naked feet. He took it all in slowly, seeming almost to savor every peculiar detail of her. Then he drew in another long breath. In a surprisingly gentle tone of voice, he said, "Jessica, what on earth are you doing here?" "Hello, Clifton," she said evenly. "How lovely to see you again." The lazy smile faded, and he glanced past her, looking quickly around the room behind her. How did I get in here?" she asked. "Easy. You still have that Heidecke rock next to the kitchen door. I'm surprised at you, Cliff. Everybody can spot those things from a mile away. Why, anyone could just walk right in here." She noticed that he was still looking around the room. "You needn't worry. I'm quite alone. We're alone together, you and I. just like old times. Isn't that strange? He was staring at her again. As strange as the thing I know not, he murmured. Then, dropping his favorite playwright, he said, They must be out looking for you. Oh, I don't think so, she said, trying desperately to make her voice sound light and carefree as she moved away from him, carefully putting the big oak desk between them. You see, darling, they don't even know I'm gone. He came farther into the room, still eyeing her warily. How did you get out of the hospital? She shrugged, deciding not to tell him lest he inform the people there. She might want to use the strategy in the future. Never mind. The point is that I'm here. Don't worry, I'm going back there as soon as we're finished here. You needn't call anyone. As soon as we're finished here, he said. And what, pray tell, are we going to do? She faced him across the length of his desk. We're going to talk, Cliff. And by the time I leave, you're going to promise me that you'll tell Dr. Granville the truth. I'm not insane, and you know it. You only said I was to get me out of your life. I'm out of your life now, and I won't ever bother you again. But you must give me my freedom. Please, Cliff, I'll go mad if I stay there. His sudden burst of laughter chilled her. He said, Well, you're in the perfect place for it, aren't you? She shut her eyes tightly. Even the voices were laughing at that one. Very funny, she admitted, opening her eyes again. But I'm serious. Mother's gone now, and I'm all alone in the world. I just want to be out of there, to finish college, and... She trailed off, fighting the sudden urge to weep. And be a novelist, he finished for her. Yes, I know. He was watching her carefully from the other side of the desk, and his smile had faded. He seemed almost sad. But you don't seem to understand something, Jessica. The court decided to send you to Northern State Hospital for a reason, a very good reason. Despite her best efforts at control, the tears were sliding down her cheeks. Because you told them to send me there, she whispered, gulping back a sob. The rain beyond the window seemed louder now, and the eyes watching her were all but piercing her hot skin. Clifton Taggart III slowly shook his head, and he leaned forward across the surface of the desk. No, Jessica. You were sent there because you're ill. You're very seriously ill. And now I'm afraid you're going to have to go back there. In a sudden, swift move, he reached down to the telephone on the desk and lifted the receiver. No! She shouted, and before she knew what she was doing, she had pulled the revolver from her coat pocket and aimed it squarely at his heart. His gasp and the clatter of the receiver as it fell to the desk were nearly drowned out by a deafening clap of thunder, and she screamed. Even her voices screamed. She recovered quickly from the shock and moved carefully around the desk toward him. He took several steps back, away from her. She stopped a few feet away from him, just beyond his reach, still aiming the gun at him. Jessica, he cried. For God's sake! Be quiet, she commanded. Just listen. I don't want to use this, but I will if I have to. Now you are going to take paper and a pen from the desk and write a letter to the hospital. He stood there, frozen, staring incredulously at her, into her eyes. You're mad, he croaked. You really are mad. Jessica Lohman continued to aim the gun at him, and a slow smile came to her lips. Suddenly, it seemed to her that she wasn't afraid anymore. She knew what to do. The voices were telling her what to do. I thought you already knew that, she murmured, her smile widening. "Isn't that what you told the court 3 years ago? I wasn't crazy then, but perhaps I'm really crazy now. You're so fond of quoting your precious Shakespeare, Cliff. Well, I can quote him too. Though this be madness, yet there is method in it." "You're going to write that letter now, and then I'll leave. I'll go back to the hospital, and you can go back to your pleasant little existence, living off the good graces of your rich wife." Even with a gun pointed at him, his vanity flared at that. "I earned everything I have," he roared, his voice trembling more with indignation than fear. Her laugh was harsh and cruel. She even surprised herself with the sound. "Dolores is the one with the money, not you." "I am America's leading authority on..." "Yes, yes, I know all about that," she said, cutting him off. She took a step toward him, unaware that she was slowly lowering the gun as she spoke. "And how much do they pay you for your expertise in the works of Shakespeare? What sort of fortune have you made from it? Your arcane knowledge may dazzle a few Tweedy professors. It might even be useful to a small handful of theatrical producers. But it would hardly keep you in beer and skittles, to say nothing of red satin smoking jackets. No, Dolores provides all that for you. You're always taking things from people, Clifton, especially women. Have you ever noticed that? You used me as a temporary distraction, and you use her as a checkbook." "Oh, please," he began, taking a step toward her. "Stay where you are," she cried, extending the gun straight out before her again, aimed at his heart. He froze, watching her. "We know how you got rid of me," she continued. "The question is, how are you planning to get rid of Dolores when her time comes? When she no longer amuses you, when she's no longer useful to you. I suppose she'll have the bed next to mine in the nut house." This last derisive cry was punctuated by yet another sudden flash of light and a crashing rumble that made her glance over at the big window. And in that loud, wild moment, he sprang. She opened her mouth to scream, staring in horror as the man she had once loved came flying through the air toward her, his long arms stretched out before him, reaching for the gun. His fingers had nearly grasped it when she fired. The gunshot was louder than the thunder, louder than her scream, louder than the screams of all her voices. It filled the room, resounding through her body, ripping through the last gossamer threads that had attached her so tenuously to sanity. Even as it crested, Clifton came crashing into her, sending her flying back across the desk as the gun flew from her hand. He fell with her, and for a long, awful moment, he was actually lying on top of her, the heavy weight of him pressed against her in a grim parody of the lovemaking they had once enjoyed, his face between her breasts. Then, as she lay there, screaming, the body of Clifton Taggart III slid slowly down, away from her. He crumpled to the carpet, rolled over onto his back, and lay still. When she could will herself to move again, she pushed herself awkwardly up from the desk to a standing position, staring down at the body that now lay at her feet. She swayed and nearly fell, but then she shut her eyes and drew in a long, deep breath. In that moment, she became aware of the change that had occurred inside her. She was no longer frightened, no longer surprised by what she had just done. Another deep breath. In fact, she was amazed at how calm she felt, how clear-headed. He had attacked her, and she had shot him. And now he was dead. She felt unaccountably good, almost exhilarated. Yes, that was the word. She was actually happy. She prodded him with her bare foot, and then she began to giggle. but she quickly clamped a hand over her mouth to stifle the sound. She didn't need the doctors from Northern State Hospital to tell her that this was the first stage of shock. She shook her head to clear it, to rid herself of the voices that continued to whisper and the eyes that continued to watch her. She was in the act of reaching down in front of the desk to retrieve the fallen gun when she heard the distinct sound above the rain from outside. A car engine. An automobile had pulled into the driveway outside, and now it was approaching the house. Dolores Taggart, home from her bridge club. Leaving the gun where it lay on the carpet, she turned her attention to the body sprawled a few feet away. Her mind seemed oddly clear to her. She didn't even have to think about what she was going to do. But she knew she must act quickly and get out of here, back to the hospital. She bent down over him, grabbing him firmly under each arm, and dragged him across the carpet and the wooden floor to the window. She propped the body against the wall there while she raised the lid of the window seat. Then she pulled him up and over the side. He was heavy, but she managed to lower his head and torso gently into the seat's interior. Then she picked up his legs and folded them in as well. She straightened up, gazing down at him. He lay there, eyes wide open. And as she stared down, she fancied that he grinned up at her and winked. But of course he didn't really do that, she admonished herself. He's dead. Another flash of lightning, another peal of thunder, and through this and the sound of the rain she distinctly heard the sound of a car door slamming. She turned immediately toward the door to the kitchen. She would go out the way she had come in, and then it was a quick run through the fields beside the roads, back to the hospital. The rain would drench her, and it was a long way to run, but she felt a sense of energy and purpose that she knew would see her through. She could get past the old man with the newspaper at the security desk. By now he was probably dozing, and she'd be in her bed and asleep before anyone noticed. Yes, she told herself as she ran across the room. I can do this. She was nearly to the door when Mother spoke to her. She heard her mother's voice as clearly as she could hear the incessant rain outside, as clearly as she now heard the sounds of the front door opening and slamming shut when Dolores Taggart entered the house. It was definitely Mother's voice, along with the sibilant whispers of the other voices. But Mother's two words were the words she heard most clearly. Mother said, "The gun!" She stopped, staring at the door in front of her, and then she turned around. The gun! Yes, there it was, lying in plain sight on the carpet, right in front of the desk. She was across the space in a flash, bending down to scoop up the weapon in one hand and reaching with her other hand for the hem of her nightgown under the black trench coat. She quickly wiped the weapon on the cotton material as best she could, ran around the desk, and replaced it in the drawer. She glanced around the room as she ran back over to the kitchen door. Yes, everything seemed to be as it had been before she arrived. It might be hours, even days, before Cliff's body was discovered. She yanked open the door and slipped out of the room just as she heard the light knock on the opposite door and a woman's voice calling, "Cliff? Cliff, darling, I'm home." She reached back to close the kitchen door as the opposite door began to open. Just as she pulled her door silently shut, she heard the voices whispering again. One voice in particular. Mother. Mother whispered, "The window seat!" She froze in the darkness outside the room, leaning back against the heavy door through which she'd just made her escape. She squeezed her eyes shut, trying to picture the scene inside the room. When she realized, she felt a brief stab of pure panic. Mother was right, of course. She'd left the lid of the window seat wide open, resting against the window. Even then, in that moment, she didn't despair. The surge of panic immediately evaporated, and that odd feeling of confidence came back to her. The same emotion she'd experienced when she looked down and saw her tormentor lying dead at her feet. She stayed there for a moment, silent, leaning back against the door, listening to the sounds from the room beyond it. In her mind's eye, she saw an elegant, dark-haired woman, about 40, probably wearing fancy evening clothes. She would have removed her raincoat already, and it would be hanging in the front hall closet with her wet umbrella. The woman came into the room, shutting the door behind her. "Cliff? Darling, are you?" Silence. Dolores would be looking around the empty room now, wondering why the lights were still on, wondering why the lid to the window seat was... Footsteps. The woman had seen, and she was going over to the window to investigate. She kept her eyes tightly shut, not daring even to breathe, seeing the action unfolding in her mind. The rain continued. The voices were silent now, but the eyes watched intently. From where she was outside the room, she couldn't see the flash of lightning at the window, but she heard the loud thunderclap that followed it. Dolores would be at that window now, leaning over, peering down. The sudden scream from the woman in the study seemed to rock the entire house. She could feel the vibration of it in the wood of the door pressing into her back. She opened her eyes in the darkness now, smiling in triumph. The blood-curdling shriek was followed almost immediately by another one, and another. The screaming went on and on, drowning out the rain. She listened to Dolores Taggart's cries, and she began to laugh softly to herself. From somewhere far away, she could hear Mother and all the others applauding her. They approved of what she'd done. Time to move. The police would be here in a matter of minutes. Now for my getaway, she thought. Still laughing, she stepped forward into the darkness. She didn't get far. She'd only taken a couple of steps away from the door when three figures suddenly materialized out of the shadows to stand before her, their bodies forming a solid wall. Two large men dressed in black, and between them a smaller figure, a severe-looking middle-aged woman in a white jacket and skirt, her gray hair pulled back in a tight bun. She froze, staring at them, wondering if they could possibly be real. Was this yet another hallucination? No, these people were real. They were very real. This must be a nurse from Northern State Hospital, she thought, and these men are security guards. They must have been aware of her escape earlier tonight, and they followed her here, which meant they had probably seen what she had done. The three of them stood there, watching her, barring her escape. She gasped and took a step backward. No, she cried. The three figures continued to stare silently at her, into her eyes, frowning. She looked wildly about her, finally turning around to face the door through which she'd just come. It was her only possible chance. She threw herself at it, but as she reached down to clutch the knob, the door flew open, and two more people came out toward her. The first was an attractive 40-ish woman in a silver lamé evening gown. The second was the man she'd just killed. She gasped again and brought her hands up to her mouth, staring at them. As they loomed up before her in the darkness, the bloody ghost of Clifton Taggart III, her dead lover, leaned down and pecked her lightly on the cheek. "You're wonderful, darling," he whispered in her ear. "I just love you." Then he took his smiling wife's hand and led her off into the shadows. She watched them floating away from her, thinking, "I really am mad, after all." She whirled around again, away from the dreadful vision, and she immediately collided with the middle-aged woman who waited behind her. The nurse from the hospital! She'd forgotten all about her. The two men in black had not moved either, and all three were watching her intently. Gasping again, she brought her arms up in automatic self-defense. She didn't want to go back to that awful place, and now they'd never let her out. Not ever. "Oh, God," she thought. "Oh, dear God." "That was great, honey. Just great," the nurse said, grabbing her firmly by the elbow. "But you can drop that method stuff now. We have to get you changed for the second act." She blinked at the woman, focusing on her, and then the words registered. She blinked some more as the real world came rushing in at her. The panic and confusion ebbed away, replaced by a sense of numbness that slowly filled her body. She lowered her arms to her sides, taking in another long, deep breath. After a moment, she smiled, and she nodded. The sound of applause continued in the background, from beyond the fallen curtain. Mother was out there, in the third row, applauding with the others, and all the voices were shouting their approval. Later, at the opening night party, Mother would tell her how marvelous it was. By Reason of Insanity was going to be a hit. Still smiling, transforming herself as she moved, she allowed the wardrobe mistress to lead her away, past the two admiring stagehands, and up the stairs to her dressing room.
That was Tom Savage reading his story, The Method in Her Madness, from the June 2005 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Tom's latest story for AHMM is Jumbie Tea, and he writes about it on our blog, Trace Evidence. That's trace-evidence.net. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital versions are now available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Magster, Sony, Zinio, and now on Google Play for your Android. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Clarissa McLaughlin. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine, and thanks for tuning in.